Hello and welcome once again to Radio Verulam 92.6 FM. You are with me, Jason McKenna, talking to your local politicians. And today's guest is MP Daisy Cooper. She's here to answer your questions. But remember, if you've not been lucky enough to get answers from Daisy this time, she will be back again next month to field those questions. But without further ado, let's get into those questions. So, Daisy, we do start off with the heartbreak of the Three Lions. England lost in the Euro 2020 final, but where did you watch it and were you still able to enjoy it?
Of course, I really, really enjoyed watching it and really enjoyed the whole tournament, to be honest. I'm not massively into football, I'll be honest, and I don't really follow it, but I just thought it was really exciting that England got to the final, and with every single step, the closer we got, the more exciting it became, I think. So I watched it in the Great Northern. They just had a few of the locals, a few of the regulars round that were a bit nervous about, any kind of walk-ins or what have you. So it was a fairly small crowd of us watching it in the garden of the Great Northern, which was great.
Sounds fantastic. But I think, did you have double disappointment because you had England in the sweepstake as well at work? I can see you smiling there. I mean, I don't know if you want to tell us who the winner was, but were they happy that Italy won or were they conflicted because I'm sure they were supporting England as well?
It was bittersweet. Yeah, it was one of my members of staff who ultimately won the sweepstake. And she said it was a bittersweet result for her, yeah.
Well, with the loss of England, though, I mean, we're talking their kind of joviality and everything because football is just a game. But after that match, we kind of saw heartbreaking fallout from it because of racist abuse that was directed towards the England stars. And once again, this fallout has brought questions about social media, racism, abuse. A lot of things have been said over the last few days. One of them is that IDs might be the way forward. Is this the right way to go, Daisy? If not, what other ideas would be useful to put in place?
You mean like ID for people who are signing up to use social media sites? Is that what you mean?
Yes, yeah. So that people are kind of fully disclosed about who they are.
Sure. I mean, first things first, I mean, that racism was just disgusting. And it has been throughout the tournament. It's just so, so disgusting. And I'm also of the view that, there are members of this government, Tory government, that were stoking the flames. And that's one of the phrases that one of the footballers used as well. And I think, it's right that people are asking questions about, fake culture wars and stoking up divisions. I think it's a really cheap shot because culture wars and, legitimising people who are racist and use racist language, legitimizing them in that kind of way, really, might win a few votes, but it divides countries, and I think it's pretty disgusting. I should also say as well, the young men in our football team at the moment, aren't they just astonishing role models? These guys have been, one of them is a homelessness campaigner, another has been leading the charge on free school meals. Others have been tackling homophobia, and encouraging young people to come out. I mean, it's just, they are just the peak of leadership and courage and compassion. And I just think they are fantastic role models. And for me, that's what made it really, really sad that we lost. Anyway, coming on to your question about social media. There's lots of different things that I think need to happen. I mean, the first thing to recognize is that when you have an unregulated space, in whatever area, right? If there's an area of activity in our country that is unregulated, then you get bad behavior and you have these vacuums of power where sort of hate and abuse and bad practice can flourish. And one of the particular problems with social media is that social media is designed to get reactions, right? So the more controversial somebody is, you can be, just to say something really, really gushing about an issue, something that you really love, or you can have something that's very hate-fueled, but it has to be a very emotional thing to drive the traffic. And therefore, things like, hate and racism drive traffic on social media. And we've got to find a way of regulating social media so that stops happening. So in terms of ID, on a personal level, it's important to make the distinction between having a social media platform, being able to identify who you are, and having the public being able to identify who you are. So there's a big distinction between that. I don't particularly have a problem with social media platforms being able to know who you are. And I think actually a lot of this behavior could be tackled if people are asked to force to register, you know, with some form of ID or personal details or something that can be verified. I think that's certainly a way to go. But that doesn't mean that you'd need to be publicly identifiable to any, you know, to anybody who's on that site. There's lots of reasons why people don't want to be publicly available, publicly identifiable. You know, teachers, for example, don't want their kids finding their private accounts. You know, doctors and nurses are often the same. So you know, there's lots of good reasons why people, you know, wouldn't want to be ID'd. But that's one thing. The other is we've got to tackle this issue of social media sites encouraging reactions and promoting these posts. It is possible for them to change the algorithms so that when you get hate-filled speech, that they deprioritize that in their algorithms rather than pushing it further up. And I'm just pretty alarmed, quite frankly, that these big companies haven't tackled that yet. It's long overdue, and we need to see some urgent action to get that in place.
Do you find it disappointing as well from these companies that they will remove almost immediately posts that contravene copyright, but they will not remove posts that are incredibly hate-filled or abusive and cause maybe harm to a certain individual?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, the social media companies, we need a regulatory framework within which this happens, because if we don't agree publicly through a democratic process how it should be regulated, what you have at the moment are these big social media companies regulating themselves completely. And when they're regulating themselves, effectively you've got Facebook and Twitter and the others, they're the arbiters of free speech, they're the arbiters of truth. We don't have any kind of democratic input around that, and that's why I think it's really important that parliaments, you know, individually and collectively, and have a democratic conversation about what the right measures are to put these, you know, restrictions and regulations in place. Because the position we have at the moment is that some things go completely unchallenged, but it's the social media platforms themselves that can decide what is truth, what is fake, you know, what's okay, what isn't. And we've seen loads of examples of where this has been a problem. I'll give you two quick examples. One where women have been breastfeeding, and that's been, you know, been reported as being nudity, and then all these women are seeing their pictures of, you know, maybe either breastfeeding their baby being taken down. You know, and another is, you know, women tattooists who might tattoo women's breasts after surgery. Pictures, those kind of pictures get taken down as well. And so it's very complicated leaving it to the big tech companies there on their own. We need to have that public conversation and produce a regulatory framework through democratic means.
Talking of public conversation in Parliament, you asked the government to address the issue of school children missing teaching. You explained your belief that a rapid task force to keep schools open safely is needed. What progress has been made after you made your comments to the House?
Not a lot, if I'm honest. So I wrote to the minister. I got a 5-page response, which was very, very, very waffly, and basically detailed all the things that have been going on for the last few weeks and months, but didn't fundamentally tackle the main issue, which is that, you know, kids had a few days left at school. Many of the schools have just closed early. Children have missed out on learning. They've missed out on rites of passage at school. You know, many parents have missed out on school assemblies and sports days while seeing these enormous, you know, events going ahead. You know, on Monday, you know, the government is opening up, you know, easing many of the restrictions and saying, you know, unlimited numbers of people can go into a nightclub, and yet there are parents who couldn't see their kids, you know, at sports days and school assemblies. So I think, you know, parents and kids feel incredibly hard done by, and understandably so. So I called for a rapid task force. The government hasn't set up anything of that shape or form, so that hasn't happened. I have had a conversation with the schools minister where he has assured me that plans are in place for the start of next term. So when kids return to school in September, there will be initially some on-site testing. So kids will get tested on-site at school. And then after the first few days, that they'll then be encouraged to continue doing testing, you know, at home. The bubbling system is going to be scrapped. Test and trace is going to be run by the NHS rather than by schools. It does rather beg the question how and whether young people who are trying to concentrate at school will be able to remember all the different people they've met during the course of the day. If they're phoned up by the NHS in, you know, big class sizes, will they know, you know, who they were sitting next to or walk past at, you know, in every single lesson? Who knows, right? So I'm very concerned that unless the government gets its act together on things like ventilation, because the government is still refusing to provide, you know, proper ventilation systems to school classrooms. Unless the government takes some more of these measures, possibly reintroduces masks in schools, et cetera, then I'm really, really worried at this point in time that, you know, come the autumn, we're going to see, you know, increasing numbers of COVID, and young people who aren't vaccinated will then have to continue to self-isolate, you know, and if this happens, it's basically unforgivable, because we can see it coming down the track. It's like watching a slow motion car crash. We've warned the government, and by now it really should have got a plan in place.
Since we began talking, Daisy, we had quite a few people message in about undersized building projects in the area, but the recent figures show that St Albans house prices have reached their highest average in history. Are you worried about young people being priced out of the area, and what can be done about this?
Yeah, so I mean, this is a huge issue, and I am really worried about young people getting priced out of the area, and priced out from renting as well as from buying, right? There's a lot of young people who can't even afford to rent in St Albans anymore, and you know, I know a number of them who've moved to other areas as a result. I mean, I guess the first thing to say is that, you know, we do have a housing crisis in this country. We do need more houses, but we need measures that are going to work. So, for example, we need the right kind of houses in the right kind of places, and we need houses that are affordable, you know, rather than just lots of, you know, new mansions or what have you in different places. So, I mean, the first thing is that the government has really got to stop subsidising, you know, many, I have to be honest, first time buyers and what have you with stamp duty breaks, because that artificially then inflates the prices and then puts them out of the reach of many people. We need to be building more social homes, you know, here in St Albans, I'm really delighted that the Lib Dem-led St Albans District Council has really, really focused on that, and there's new sort of, you know, pockets of social homes popping up all over the place. As I say, we need schemes in place to help people both rent and buy. And certainly in our manifesto, the Lib Dem manifesto at the last general election, we had outlined how we would help do that with a kind of help to rent and then a kind of rent to buy scheme as well, to help people at different stages. It's a big worry. And I know it's a worry for many families in St Albans who want their children to be able to stay in the area.
On the flip side, do you think that in the St Albans area or areas around the country, there's a reluctance to build housing? It's almost like a vicious circle of maybe the term used is NIMBYism, but, you know, we want more housing, we want affordable housing, but not in my area. Do you think that people might have to change their attitudes towards building projects going forward?
So, in my experience, the biggest frustration of local residents is when there are proposals for housing where there is no associated infrastructure. And that's the problem. So, I mean, there are a number of different issues. You know, overall, as a country, we do need more housing, right? So we know that. The question is how much and where should it go? We do have a major issue here in Hertfordshire, which isn't particularly in St Albans, which is in St Albans, our district is about 95-97% greenbelt. And we're being told by the government simultaneously that it wants us to build thousands of new homes whilst also protecting the green belt. Well, you know, it's one or the other. And I think, you know, part of the issue with the planning system as a whole nationally is that planning used to be done on a county basis or equivalent to a county basis. So you could look across the whole of the county and make sure that any new homes would be designed with infrastructure in place, etc. But now it isn't, it's on a district level. So you've got district councils designing where housing should go, and you've got a county council that decides where to put the infrastructure, and these things don't always marry up. So I think people have lots of different frustrations. And the other thing is that local people need to be able to have a say on what kind of houses there are and how many there should be. And under the Conservatives' planning proposals, local communities would have no say at all on what kind of housing there would be or where it would go, and give sort of free rein to people to suddenly increase the height of their building as well. So I think what's important is that you have a planning system that should be integrated, so that you have development of homes with infrastructure that should go hand in hand, and we don't have that at the moment. Secondly, I think in some areas, particularly where you have greenbelt, which quite honestly benefits us all, there has to be an honest conversation about whether areas in the greenbelt can sustain the levels of housing that we're being asked to build. And then third, you have to make sure there's community involvement and community-led planning, rather than leaving it up to developers to decide where they want to build.
Also this month, you voted against the protest crackdown bill, which you described as illiberal and authoritarian. Why was your party's bid to remove the protest element from the bill rejected? And what hope is there for future peaceful protesting in the UK?
It's a very good question. I mean, the reason why we didn't like this particular section of the of what we regard as the protest crackdown bill is that it would give the government and they give the police by extension the powers to arrest a single person who was protesting on their own, who was making some noise which somebody decided was making a bit of a nuisance. Now the whole point of going on a protest is that you make a flipping nuisance of yourself. That's the whole point of going on a protest. It's to make noise, it's to disrupt, you know, disrupt people's awareness so that they realize that there's an issue that you care about. It gives them it's a tool for the powerless and the voiceless, basically. And what this bill would say is, well, you can arrest any single person who's standing in the middle of a road holding a banner, you know, like that single nurse that we saw standing in the middle of in Parliament, you know, during the pandemic. Under these powers, you know, she, like under the COVID powers, she could be arrested. And I think that's just absolutely shocking. So we wanted this particular section of this bill deleted. Why was our bid to remove it rejected? I mean, you'd have to ask the Conservatives. The Conservative government that kept it in there, my sense and my view is that it was really because the government has enjoyed having lots of powers during COVID and it's reluctant to give them back. And I see this as a very worrying trend where the government seems to be intent on taking freedoms away rather than protecting our freedoms.
So with you putting that proposal to them to change the law there, did they not offer any sort of explanation as to why they rejected it out of hand?
I mean, not particularly. I mean, the fact is the government says that it needs to make sure that it can keep law and order, and the government likes to have a good, you know, it talks a good game on law and order. But quite frankly, you know, the right to protest is a human right. It is an inalienable right, which means that any other kind of legislation to do with COVID or anything else is secondary to this fundamental right to protest. It's part of our democratic rights and responsibilities, and it can't be taken away. And I think the Conservative government's attempts to clamp down on that protest is to basically silence people who disagree with it. And from my side, you know, from my point of view, that is illiberal and it is authoritarian, and we shouldn't be putting up with it in this country.
Would you say then that for people listening that the Liberal Democratic Party is going to be one of the only parties to defend free speech truthfully, instead of maybe these measures that the Conservative Party are bringing in, saying are protecting free speech, but aren't actually?
Well, I mean, there are lots of, you know, Lib Dems, you know, it's in our name, right? As liberals, we defend free speech. We, you know, we are defenders of our freedoms, and that's something in our civil liberties. That's, you know, at the core of who we are and what we believe in, for sure. But it's fair to say that we are not the only ones. You know, there are lots of different parties in Parliament who are vehemently against these particular very authoritarian and illiberal measures, and there are even, you know, a scattering of backbenchers in the Tory party who find them very worrying as well. I tabled amendments to the bill with the support of some backbench Conservatives as well, you know, sadly there's just not enough of them.
As always with these discussions on Radio Verulam, we are here to help the local community, and we called for questions for you. So let's move the discussion onto what the people of our local area want to know. Dave has sent in a message asking, why are the Conservative Party allowed to break a manifesto promise and cut foreign aid? Why is there no recourse for being elected under false pretenses?
Sure. I mean, first of all, on this very specific manifesto promise that the Conservative Party has cut, the promise they've broken, I mean, it's absolutely desperate, you know, and even Theresa May, you know, a former prime minister, rebelled against Boris Johnson's Conservatives the other day, rebelled against him, saying that this is a life and death measure, you know, and the fact that the government is cutting funding to the international aid budget will result in people dying. You know, it's that simple. And for those who say, well, you know, we ought to be spending that money at home, all I would say is that I'm sick to death of this government pitching the poorest people in the world against some of the poorest people in the UK. You know, we are the fifth richest country in the world. We can do better on both fronts. You know, we can invest more to tackle poverty in the UK whilst also tackling poverty around the world. It's not an either or, particularly not when we've seen you know, huge sums of money wasted on fancy yachts and painting jets, you know, with flags and, you know, a fancy media room for government ministers and contracts handed out to ministers' mates. I mean, you know, there's vast sums of money that are being squandered on things that people don't want or need, whilst actually when there are very serious matters, that money's getting cut. So that's my view on that particular policy. I mean, more broadly, what I would say is that, you know, once people are elected, you know, the manifesto is there to give you a sense of priorities as well as principles. And I think what the government have shown is that they've changed both their principles and their policies in this regard. And, you know, it's the nature of our democracy where if people don't like it, all they can do is make their voice heard at election time.
Maria has asked, with the new proposed cycling schemes looking like they will be passed in and around St Albans, will you be getting on your bike to travel around the area?
Ah, well, I do like cycling around the area, actually. I've been on some lovely little cycle rides around sort of, you know, Bedmond and you know, Brickett Wood and, you know, out to sort of Coney Heath. And I even went down one of the little tracks between a couple of fields and got a puncture in my bike a few months ago. But anyway, so yes, I do love cycling, and I'm hoping, I haven't had much time to cycle recently, so I'm hoping that I'll get a chance over the summer break. Except, well, actually, at the moment, my husband's using my bike on the turbo trainer. So once I put my bike back together, I'll definitely get back on the road.
Oh, that is fascinating use of the bike there. I mean, Scott has possibly suggested somewhere that you can go on your bike. He explains that Mayor Hill reopened the St Albans Clock Tower. Scott has asked, will you be visiting and making the climb to the top?
Oh, that's a nice idea. I could probably walk to the clock tower, so I wouldn't even need to take my bike. I think the last time I went up the clock tower, probably, I think it was summer of 2017. I went with my friend Francis, and it was a beautiful, beautiful day. And we went at the end of the day, so just as the sun was going down, it was absolutely beautiful. So that's a nice idea. I probably will go back to the clock tower and have another little go.
You seem to hit it at the right time, seeing the sun set. Now, Angela has moved it on to a more serious subject, as she explains about her two young children. She's so worried about bullying online. She said that she saw you on Twitter and that you're supporting the Don't Face It Alone campaign. She's asked, what advice can you give to protect my kids as they get older and become more involved with the internet?
It's a really, really great question. And I know that a lot of parents and guardians are very concerned about online bullying. You know, we've seen the effects over the last few years of how serious it can be and how it affects young people's mental health. I guess the main thing I would say is that I'm not an expert on this at all, but there are other people who are. And so this particular campaign called Don't Face It Alone, this is very much an awareness raising campaign, encouraging families and schools and, you know, young people's sort of social groups and what have you to put up posters to just indicate that young people don't have to be suffering in silence. They can talk to people about it. There are also information packs available for, you know, schools and school activity groups and things. And there is also an organisation called Bullying UK, which has a lot of information, advice and resources for parents who want to know how to deal with it and how to tackle it. So, as I say, I'm not an expert myself, but there's lots of resources out there for people who want to work out what they can do.
And we'll try and put all those links below as well so that people can get the advice that they do need over such an important subject. Ian has moved it on to the discussion about COVID cases. He's asked, are you worried about the massive spike in them, especially with the new variant? Or do you feel that now that the vaccine is here, that life needs to carry on as normal?
Well, first things first, you know, I know that a lot of people are very keen for things to, quote, go back to normal as things were pre-pandemic. I recognise that a lot of people do want restrictions to end. And I know that for many of our small businesses as well, you know, particularly in hospitality, but also in retail, you know, restrictions have really severely impacted them. And even with some of the government support packages, they found it incredibly hard to trade and, you know, because they haven't been working at full capacity. So I know that a lot of people are desperate for an easing of restrictions. That said, I should also say, obviously, our vaccine rollout has been good. The issue is that we still haven't vaccinated enough people to get the amount of coverage that we need to be easing all of the restrictions that the government intends to ease on Monday. Our local public health director has been answering questions on Twitter about this and sharing, you know, facts and figures. I sent out a public health message from him to people who subscribe to my community newsletter. And you know, the warnings that we're getting are quite alarming. You know, medics and scientists are saying, you know, the vaccinations have weakened the link between people getting COVID and the number of hospitalizations and deaths. But it hasn't broken that link completely. So there will still be some hospitalizations and deaths. And at the moment, with cases rising so quickly and so profoundly in terms of the overall scale, the numbers of hospitalizations and deaths will continue to grow. And at the moment, we haven't, you know, despite many of us putting questions to the government hasn't given us a steer as to actually, well, how many hospitalizations and deaths are we prepared to actually put up with? You know, we're talking about living, breathing, loving human beings here, and the government hasn't given any information about how it intends to manage that. And for every single person who goes into a hospital, that's, you know, that will consume the time and energy and skill of NHS workers who could be working on the backlog of non-COVID cases, whether that's cancer or Crohn's disease or, you know, or anything else, quite frankly. And so we are already getting warnings that the autumn's going to be difficult. We're already getting warnings that the NHS could be at breaking point in a few months' time in the early autumn. And yet the government seems to be insistent on easing all restrictions, when, to my mind, you know, I'm a liberal, I don't like it when our freedoms are restricted. But, you know, I personally, it will definitely continue to wear a mask in crowded places. And I see that as a very small price to pay to allow the clinically vulnerable to be able to leave their house, to feel able to leave their house, to make sure that I don't pass COVID on to anybody else, and to make sure that we keep rates low. I think it's a very small inconvenience to keep our other freedoms and hopefully avoid any kind of lockdown a few months down the line.
Just one last question on this particular question from Ian. Do you think that the government is not following their own rhetoric of we are following the science?
So it strikes me as being quite clear that the government is not following the medical and scientific advice at the moment. That said, it's for medical and medical advisors and scientists to give the government medical and scientific advice. It's for politicians to take decisions that balance lots of other things, including, you know, the economy and all those other things. The issue that I really get very frustrated about is that this government has portrayed this as a tension between public health and the economy, whereas in reality, public health and the economy are two sides of the same coin. Now, part of the rhetoric at the moment is the reason why we should be easing restrictions next week is to get the economy going. But in reality, we're seeing the opposite, because loads of hospitality businesses, there's a few here in St Albans, but many more around the country, you know, they've got young members, they've got very young members of staff who haven't even had one, possibly even two vaccinations. So when they get pinged, they have to go into self-isolation. And so these businesses have to close down again. So that's not helping the economy. So actually what I would much prefer is that the government could get the balance right to make sure that we're both protecting public health and supporting the economy, and keeping some of the restrictions we have in place in terms of restrictions on numbers and keeping masks on in crowded places. They're fairly small measures that would actually help us go a long way.
So the final question comes from Susan, and I hope this elicits a nice response here, but she asks, you always seem so busy and proactive. When do you have time to see your family and spend time with them?
Oh, that's a really lovely question, Susan. People do ask me this quite a lot, because I am quite busy and I do pack a lot in, but I do make time for my family. I think I saw my brother a couple of weekends ago, actually, for his birthday, and saw my mum and dad the day after. So I do make time to see family. I always say, and I say this to, you know, various friends of mine who are involved in politics, I always say health comes first, family comes second, politics comes third.
Now, as always, Daisy, thank you so much for your time, and we will see you again next month.